Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and today I welcome to the show Dr. Gleb Sapirsky. Known as a disaster avoidance expert, Dr. Sapirsky is on a mission to protect leaders from dangerous judgment errors known as cognitive biases, and he does this by developing the most effective decision-making strategies via his consulting, coaching, and training firm, Disaster Avoidance Experts. That link is in the show notes, by the way. He is a best-selling author, and his new book, which is available on Amazon and in bookstores everywhere, is Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions and Avoid Business Disasters. And we're going to be talking about decision-making, cognitive bias, leadership, and intuition, among other things. Good morning, Gleb, and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Denise. It's a pleasure to be here. I really appreciate you inviting me.
Oh, listen, I've been watching you on your website and listening to you, and I find you absolutely fascinating. And I'm pretty convinced that you are about 14 years old. I mean, you look so young for a man who has so many really wonderful things under his belt. So before I get started, tell people a bit about yourself that I've more than likely missed in the intro.
That's not a problem. I'm actually 38, so I was born in 81.
Seriously?
And that's right.
Okay, you need to teach people how you do this. This is great.
Well, you need to have good genes, and you need to make good decisions. And I think I make pretty good decisions about my personal health and my personal life and my well-being, which helps me look as young as I do. So, you know, that's the secret to longevity, making good decisions, right?
Absolutely. So listen, I do the same. I'm literally a mushroom. I don't drink, smoke, or go out in the sun. And I probably will look pretty darn terrific for a very, very long time because I do take care of myself. And, you know, when you do things that are just poisoning your body, you kind of expect to not feel good and look good, right? So good for you.
Yeah. And that is actually related to one of the dangerous judgment errors that I talk about in the book, Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions and Avoid Business Disasters, called hyperbolic discounting. And that's one of the problems in our brain, that tendency to overweigh short-term rewards, like all of those vices, fun vices that you mentioned, things that are not good for you, they're just good, that feel good to us. And we undercount, deprive our future selves, you know, the ones in 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, of good health and good well-being. And so we harm our future selves. You know, wouldn't it be nice if we loved our future selves as much as we love our current selves? Those people, the future selves that we will be, deserve our care, respect, love, and support. And unfortunately, that's not the tendency, that's not the intuition, that's not the gut reaction for us. So I deliberately go against that hyperbolic discounting where we discount the future and we overweigh the present. And that's applicable to all sorts of business decisions as well as personal decisions. And that's how you can motivate yourself to make both better business decisions and personal decisions and look younger, be healthier, and have a much better life.
And see, I've never heard that term before, but it does make sense. And one thing that I have noticed, I'm guilty of it, I think most of us are, as you know, young children and teenagers, we're convinced that we're bulletproof. We're not. Mm-hmm. But we just think, oh, you know, we'll worry about that later. I'm okay. I can do this. And then about 30 years on, you're going, oh, geez, what was I thinking? Well, the truth is you weren't thinking. But it sounds like you are and have been, and you're teaching other people to do that. And I love that idea because seriously, no matter what age you are, you can always make yourself better starting right now.
Yes, I agree with that sentiment. And it's very important to understand that what you're doing is not intuitive. And here is the difficulty that all of us have, pretty much all of us. There's no one to whom it's intuitive to be long-term oriented. We have to train ourselves to do it. We have to go from our natural state, intuitive state, our savage, primitive state, which underweighs the future and overweighs the present, to being more civilized, long-term oriented, focused on our success. Now, think about where our gut reactions come from. There's a reason I call the book Never Go With Your Gut. Our gut reactions are not adapted for our current complex environment. You know, right now, if you take good care of yourself, you can easily live to 90, 100, you know, maybe with future science, you can live to, you know, 1,000. I have no idea, but within our lifetime. But realistically speaking, with the science we have right now, you can probably live to 90 and 100 in a relatively reasonable health if you take care of yourself. But that's not what our gut tells us, because our gut is adapted for the savanna environment, not the modern environment. It's adapted for that hunter and forager environment where our ancestors lived in small tribes of 15 to 150 people and had to fight the fight or flight response and so on. And I can go into that later about bad decisions. But the crucial thing about longevity is that, you know, if you were 40 years old, you were old at that time.
You right. You didn't likely really live. Yeah, you were one of the elders. And
right.
even in the 30s, 40s, you know, around those eras, kind of the same thing. You just really didn't live to be old bones.
Exactly. So we...
Because I think those are the right decades, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, and we are undercounting. We intuitively undercount just our gut reactions, our feelings, our intuitions, our instincts. They undercount the future. And that's one of the reasons why they do so. Because realistically, you're not going to live into the future. And from the perspective of what you need to do for yourself, it was better for someone in the savanna environment to live more for the moment and indulge in various vices and so on, because the future was not going to be nearly as important to them. They would die much longer, you know, before they reached 50, almost certain. So here we are in a different environment, but we still behave as though we're in that environment intuitively, if we go with our intuitions, with our gut feelings.
Now, I have to ask, how did you discover this?
Well, that has to do with a longer story of my background, how I came to study this topic. So I came to study the topic of decision-making actually by seeing my parents making some pretty bad decisions themselves. So when I was a kid, I saw them fighting with each other over really stupid, silly little things, you know, kind of things. I remember my dad fighting with my mom over a sweater she wanted to get, and she liked to have clothing that was nice, and he was very cheapskatey. So he fought with her a lot, and it was so dumb. They spent so much emotions on each other and shouted and argued with each other over really minor things, you know, sweater worth, you know, $50 or something like that. And they had a lot of these conflicts, which I already as a kid saw were a bad idea, were really harmful for them and their relationship. But a really bad one, and they were both very gut-oriented. When they felt something was right, that meant to them it was completely right, and anyone who disagreed with them was dumb and wrong and completely, you know, how can you disagree with me? I'm obviously right, because I feel I'm right. And so they fought with each other a lot. There was this one time that was really bad, when my dad, he was a real estate agent, so he worked on commissions, and he made variable commissions. And so he made variable income, which, you know, sometimes he made more, sometimes he made less. And this one time, there was a period of time when he made a lot of money, but he hid it from my mom and he invested it into buying an apartment elsewhere that he leased out. And so in a couple of years, once my mom found out, she was very pissed at him. She was very angry. They had this huge blowout fight, and they actually ended up separating for a while. So that was very harmful and very traumatic for me as a child, when I saw my parents, because of a terrible decision by my dad, very clearly separating for a while. They got back together eventually, but she could never really trust them again. So that really shaped my childhood, and that really made me fascinated with why people make bad decisions and how can you prevent them. Because my values from when I was a kid were utilitarian, meaning I wanted the most good for the most number. And I saw that a lot of adults make bad, dumb decisions that cause a lot of suffering for themselves and their kids. So that was kind of the childhood. Then when I grew up, I mentioned I was born in 1981. I grew up, I came of age in 1999 when, you know, there were the Boo.com, Pets.com, Webvan, and other tech companies were booming. They had a lot of money. All the dot-coms were booming. And, you know, tech leaders were partying like it's 1999, for those who remember that Prince song. And so that was that time of really boom for the tech companies, dot-coms. And then a couple of years later, when I was 21, 2002, they all went bust. They lost a lot of money. Yeah, billions and billions of dollars were lost. And so people who are supposedly the heroes, you know, in the Wall Street Journal, CNBC, Inc., Time, the venues I write for, they suddenly became the zeros. You know, they were on the front page for the right reasons and the front page for the wrong reasons. And so I saw that people who were celebrated, who were the heroes, can immediately become zeros in a very short time period. So clearly their decision-making was off. The people who are making the decisions about the investment, the tech leaders, as well as the journalists who are writing about them. Now, even worse in a way was what happened soon after that, when it was discovered that the leaders at Enron, WorldCom, and Tyco, and other companies used fraudulent accounting methods to hide their losses. So they used fraud to hide their losses. Now, that was horrible decision-making on their part because, I mean, it couldn't last. They would know that in a year or two, the fraudulent accounting would be discovered. And look what happened. I mean, they did the perp walk. They, you know, went to jail, and so many terrible things happened to them. And they couldn't have not known. They very, very likely knew that it would only be a matter of time. And their bad decision-making, terrible decision-making, caused so much suffering for people around them, people, employees of their companies who lost their life savings because they invested into the retirement fund, into the stocks of the companies, and so on. And so it was really bad and very traumatic for so many people. And again, for someone who with a value set of utilitarianism, that made me, again, especially fascinated and passionate about seeing what can be done to address this bad decision-making. So I began to study the topic already from, you know, in the 1990s when my parents were making these bad decisions, and especially more in business oriented from when I saw these bad decisions in the dot-coms and so on. And I started doing training, consulting, coaching on these topics. And at a certain point, I saw that I needed more education. So I went into academia, so studying this formally, doing research on this, getting a PhD in the history of behavioral science, looking at the combination of how we make our decisions, the cognitive neuroscience aspects of decision-making, and how we specifically behave and decide in economic settings. So focusing on behavioral economics, how we decide in economic settings. And that's kind of what led to me here. I wrote a number of books. I was featured in a number of magazines, articles, you know, CBS News and so on, which I can go into that. But I brought together all of my experience in this latest book, Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions and Avoid Business Disasters, to focus specifically on business. My previous books talked about some business, some personal life, and so on. This one specifically focuses on business and how do you make the best decisions in business and avoid those decision disasters that leaders tend to suffer if they don't make decisions using an effective process and just go with their gut.
Exactly. And I have the book. Thank you so much for sending it to me.
You're welcome.
Okay, so it sounds to me like you just happened to be serendipitously, if you like, in the right time, in the right eras, in the right disasters, in a way of speaking, when you needed to be. But better than that, you were paying close attention. And some
well,
people
it was shaping me. It was shaping me as a kid. You know, so from when I was a kid, I saw the bad decision was really harming me. And being someone who wanted to prevent damage to other people, I harm suffering for other people and for myself, of course, as well. I saw that, hey, this is something I really need to study and understand what's going on. And this is a real difference that I can make for others because our decision-making has not improved at all.
No.
For the last...
Isn't that sad?
Yeah.
Some of the things that are going on now, and didn't I read about this 20 years ago? Come on.
Yep.
It just keeps on going.
It really does. It really does, and it's terrible. You know, people were saying that the best way to decide is to go with your gut 100 years ago. They're still just saying that now. It's still just as bad. I mean, it would be the same as if in medicine the doctors who were smelling snake oil 100 years ago were still smelling snake oil today.
Oh, it's gotten worse, you know, because now we have bigger, you know, amplifiers. Everybody can hear it. It's crazy.
Right,
but I wanted to ask you about intuition, because I'm one of those people, mm-hmm. I really do strongly pay attention to my intuition. But I have to say, I also temper that with, hang on a second. Okay, you've got the idea. You're getting, you know, you're getting a message from somewhere. Let's just call it the ether, you know, whatever it is. But I don't instinctively immediately act on it anymore, unless it's like, don't get on that plane, then I don't get on the plane. but you know, when it's a business related thing, I'll say, oh, well, let me think about that. And you know where these intuitions come from? Either at 3:18 in the morning, my subconscious wakes me up without fail, or I'm in the shower and I'll get a really great idea. And I know it's not my idea, because it came from the ether, if you will. But I got really smart and I bought bathtub crayons. Now I scribble all over my wall. I take a picture of it, right, and then, you know, scrub down the wall. But I've learned through trial and error that sometimes those instincts are, they may be terrific, but this may not be the right time. What do you think?
So we have to think about what is intuition. And the problem with intuition, and just with gut reactions in general, in terms of how we talk about them, unfortunately, we use gut reaction, intuition, for in a very fuzzy way, in a way that really looks, signifies a lot of different things. Somebody might say, you know, my intuition tells me that I need to eat that third chocolate chip cookie. You feel with your gut that that's the right thing to do. And people do
your
it.
Your intuition is lying to you.
Well, there you go. I mean, so that's kind of the feeling. When you feel tempted to eat that third chocolate chip cookie, it feels the same thing. It feels intuitive. It feels right. It feels you're comfortable with that. You have to really learn that that's not the right thing to do for your health. So we have learned that because there's research showing that and so on. Or, you know, our intuition we might feel comfortable. Our intuition might tell us to sit on the couch and watch TV all day, but we know that that's not good for our health either. So we put on our sweats and go to the gym, or, you know, go running, or whatever exercise you do. And that's not a comfortable thing. You know, going to the gym is not like a fun thing. Maybe for someone it is, but it's not for me. And for the vast majority of people, it's not. It's not an intuitive thing. Your intuition doesn't tell you you need to go to the gym. You have to make that decision, and you have to go against what's comfortable. You have to go outside of your comfort zone. You have to go outside of your intuition. You have to go against your intuition. You have to go against your gut reactions to go there. So those are just some examples we've learned.
Is it intuition? I'm sorry. In these things that you're referencing here, is it intuition or is it just self-indulgence? Because when I know, when I'm about to do something silly like open the refrigerator door and scan the shelves and go, when I'm not in the tiniest bit hungry, I'm probably a lot more thirsty than anything. Mm-hmm. I don't call that intuition. I call that you're being an idiot, Denise, so self-indulgence. I have talked with myself. I live alone. I can do this.
Trick. Well, there you go. So here's the trick or the problem, that we can't tell intuitively. We can't tell internally. We can't just look at introspect and see the difference between when something is good for us or when something's bad for us. It all feels comfortable. Well, our intuition feels comfortable. Our gut reactions feel comfortable. We do what's comfortable for us. So unfortunately, we can't distinguish between when we feel impelled, when our emotions call on us to do the right things or to do the wrong things. It's impossible for us to distinguish these things intuitively. We need to use our head. We need to check with our brain. We need to check with our head whether this is the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. And that is the challenge, that when you talk about intuition, or you talk about gut reactions, or you talk about being authentic, or however you want to signal that area, which is emotions. What we're talking about here is emotions. We can't trust our emotions because we can't tell apart the good ones from the bad ones. And that is a big challenge. That's why we need to use our head to check our gut. And so here's the critical things to realize. Our gut reactions, as I mentioned, come from the savanna environment. And there are a number of dangerous judgment errors called cognitive biases, and we talked about one of them earlier, that cause us to make really bad decisions. And we need to watch out for those. We need to learn what they are. Now, in the savanna environment, it was very important for us to be tribal. Tribalism was critical for us to survive. If we weren't tribally oriented, we would die if our tribe kicked us out, if our tribe didn't survive. We couldn't survive by ourselves. So we have very strong temptation right now, intuition, gut reaction, to work with people like us, to have relationships with people like us, to think that people who are like us are better, and that people who are not like us, who are not part of our tribe, are worse, are bad, feel hostile to them. So that's the tribalism. That's one of two aspects of tribalism. The other aspect of tribalism is that we're tempted to climb high in the social hierarchy of the tribe, because in the tribe, that would be the person who got the most resources and was able to reproduce and spread their genes. So our ancestors are the ones who were strongly tribal, who looked like, who worked with people like them, who liked people like them, and were hostile to people who aren't, and they climbed the social hierarchy of the tribe. That's one of the reasons, biggest reasons, that the people at the top of WorldCom, and Enron, Tyco, they wanted to stay at the top of that tribal hierarchy, and they made terrible decisions to do so by using fraudulent accounting methods. They were very afraid of falling in the tribal hierarchy. They were very emotional. It was their decision-making was driven by very strong emotions, hostile emotions toward falling from that high social status and being seen as losers and failures. Now, a number of other business leaders, most business leaders, fortunately, they acknowledged that, hey, I lost a lot of money in the dot-com crash, and they didn't use fraudulent accounting methods. They were able to overcome those tribal instincts of not wanting to be seen as a loser and fall in the social hierarchy. But some of those leaders, Enron, WorldCom, and Tyco, as I mentioned, Bernie Ebers and so on, did not. And so that is an example of how this sort of tribal instinct and tribal intuition to go to the top of the tribal hierarchy really harms business leaders, really harms companies. So that's tribalism. The other aspect that's really important to remember, and we talked about hyperbolic discounting, so that's another one. The big other paradigm that's important to remember is the fight or flight response. So we are very tempted to, when we face a threat, when we pursue a threat, to react very quickly, because it was very important for us to react very quickly in the savanna environment, and to either fight or flee. So that is something that is very strong for us. It was very important for our ancestors to, jump. It was better for them to jump at 100 shadows than to miss one saber-toothed tiger and to flee from the saber-toothed tiger, or to miss an attacking tribe, which you needed to fight the attacking tribe. So that is something that is very tempting for us to do right now. We are very tempted to make decisions too quickly and make decisions that are either defensive or aggressive way too quickly. So right now those dynamics cause us to make a lot of bad decisions in contemporary business environments, in professional environments, and in personal environments. It was very important for tribal members in the savanna environment to eat as much sugar as possible when they came across that sugar, because that was what enabled them to survive. Right now, we have way too much sugar in our current environment.
Oh gosh,
but we're still just as tempted to eat it. So that's kind of a dynamic that's really harmful for our health, but that's a disconnect. So we need to understand that there are going to be very many disconnects between the tribal environment and the current environment, personal, business, whatever, and we need to check those gut instincts that are inborn, those gut instincts. Now, on the other hand, we have emotions that are trained and developed that are a good fit for this modern environment. So, for example, you've probably learned, everyone, how to eat with a fork and knife. That's not intuitive at all. That's something you have to learn as a kid to do, because the natural thing is to eat with our hands, and as did the tribal ancestors. And you had to learn that. Now it feels very intuitive and correct to eat with a fork and knife, unless you're eating pizza. And if you eat pizza with a fork and knife, you're weird, but whatever.
True. And now, I've seen it.
Yep.
Really?
I know.
And chicken.
I know.
How do you eat a drumstick with a knife and fork? I've seen that too, and I find it entertaining, but I wouldn't try it. I'd probably hurt myself.
Well, there you go. You've also learned how to do things like brush your teeth, which is completely not intuitive, and take showers occasionally, hopefully at least, in this modern environment. Now, more seriously, you've also learned how to do things, most of you, like drive a car. Driving a car is a completely not intuitive activity. I mean, right now, it will be very hard for me to deliberately force myself to not look over my shoulder when I'm switching lanes, because I've learned that and it feels intuitive. But of course, when I was learning how to drive a car, I mean, I think that was the reason why I failed my first driving test, that I wasn't correctly looking over my shoulder when I was switching lanes. So that's a completely not intuitive thing to learn. And these are just some areas, and we've talked about others, where we learned how to restrain ourselves from eating that third chocolate chip cookie, where we learned to put on sweats and go to the gym, because those are things that modern medicine and other sort of things and our parents have told us are good for our health, good for our lifestyle. Unfortunately, the same tactics don't apply to business. We don't have evidence-based business strategies, unlike evidence-based medicine, which has shown us that we really need to actually brush our teeth if we want to retain our teeth, you know, into the old age. So we're only now discovering evidence-based business strategies of how to decide effectively, how to make effective decisions in the business setting. There are some things that you've likely learned in the business setting. So for example, if you're a leader, you've probably learned how to look at a profit and loss statement and make a very quick judgment of, you know, how's the business you're doing. Or you've probably learned how to delegate tasks effectively. Again, completely unintuitive. You might have also learned how to do things that are problematic from a perspective like taking constructive critical feedback. It's not intuitive at all to do that, but you've learned how to do this difficult activity. And now hopefully you're able to do it effectively and easily. But it's not intuitive at all. Our intuitive intuition to constructive critical feedback is to be defensive or aggressive with that fight or flight response. So those are things that you've learned how to do. And that's why it's very important to understand the difference between learned healthy mental habits and the unfortunate tendencies that come from our gut intuitions that date back from the tribal savannah.
Well, that makes sense. And going back to Enron and some of those, I watched this as it was unfolding, and I didn't really understand, and probably still don't, why they did it. But you know, something you said earlier is like, you know, they didn't want to fall from the tribal hierarchy, and
yes.
I'm thinking, but they want to go to jail? I mean, they had to have known at some level that this was going to end very, very badly, yet they kept on. And some of them didn't even have sense to bail out and go to another country where there's no extradition. I'm watching this going, what the heck are you people thinking? So one of my questions is, how do top leaders and, you know, big organizations like that overcome, let's call it that, you know, fight or flight and don't want to lose their position? How do they overcome that bias and say, I'm going to make a better decision, I'm going to do the best thing for my company, for my shareholders, I'm going to do my best to stay out of jail? I mean, it seems like at some point their cognitive abilities, if you will, just shut completely down. And they were just going and going and going with no sense whatsoever. That's the way it looked to me. Am I way off?
No, you're absolutely right. And the thing is, they thought that what they were doing was going with their intuition, just like you described yourself as going with your intuition, because that's what they felt comfortable with. Our intuition is what caused us to feel comfortable with a certain course of action. When we have an idea, when, you know, let's say Bernie Ebers was in his bathtub and he had an idea, aha, I can use fraudulent accounting methods to cover up these losses. You know, he thought that was a good idea. And unfortunately, it was a terrible idea, but he felt it was a good idea. The leaders at WorldCom, Tyco, also felt it was a good idea. And that's the danger of trusting our intuition and not checking with our head, because often those instincts, the tribal hierarchy in this case, wanting to stay at the top of the tribal hierarchy, are going to be really bad for us. So that's why often what we need to do always is to check with our head, and often we'll find that our gut reactions cause us to make the wrong decisions. That's what they didn't understand. That's what they didn't do. So the thing to do, first of all, there are two very broad elements, let's say that way. There are specific techniques, science-based, evidence-based techniques that show how business leaders can make much more effective decisions. And we can talk about the techniques a little bit later, because right now you asked about how they can become aware. Now, the awareness stage is the other big aspect of things. How do you become aware that you're making the wrong decisions? And you become aware by learning about these cognitive biases. So that's the only way that you become aware. Just like you need to learn that if you don't brush your teeth will fall out eventually, and or you'll have bad breath first, then you'll have gum disease, and eventually your teeth will fall out. That's something you have to learn and take on trust, as opposed to, you know, just test it out for yourself. You don't want to wait until your teeth fall out. So what you need to do is learn about what the science on this topic says about what are these cognitive biases. And you can look at others around you. You know, other people have their teeth fall out. So you can see that, hey, you might have your teeth fall out if you don't go to the dentist regularly, don't practice good dental hygiene. So you need to learn that if you discount the future, the hyperbolic discounting cognitive bias, that's going to really damage your company in the long run. One of the big problems, and people who are pretty smart and savvy about our current business environment know that some of these are definitely challenges. So for example, if you see Warren Buffett at Berkshire Hathaway talking about how the quarterly earnings reports are very dangerous from the perspective of long-term maintenance and stability for companies, that causes a very short-term orientation for their leadership. And that is a classic case of hyperbolic discounting, where their leadership is undercounting the future, you know, discarding the future for the sake of short-term gains. So harming long-term future for the sake of short-term gains. So that's kind of just one out of many tendencies that you need to learn about. Another one that, you know, not hyperbolic discounting, another cognitive bias, so dangerous judgment error, is called the planning fallacy. Now, this is a really interesting one. You've probably heard people telling you that failing to plan is planning to fail. Again, failing to plan is planning to fail. It's a pretty common phrase that indicates that the people are trying to tell you that you really should make a lot of plans. Unfortunately, for the people who make these plans, the tendency in our gut reactions is to have very high opinions of ourselves and our plans. We think we're great. We think we're awesome. We think our plans are great and awesome. And the problem with that is that we tend to think our plans, whatever plans we'll make, will come true. So we make plans, business leaders make strategic plans as though those plans will come true. And they invest those their resources of time, money, social capital, other resources into those plans. And unfortunately, very often their plans will not come true because problems will come up that harm their plans, that damage their future, and they don't anticipate these problems. And so that really leads business leaders in the wrong direction, this planning fallacy. And of course, it leads everyone to the wrong direction. If you think about, let's say, if you're planning a wedding and you are just thinking, hey, everything will go well, there's all this good stuff, and then some unexpected things come up that cause the things to go off tracks a little bit. A lot of people who are planning weddings get incredibly stressed about this because they just don't anticipate that things will go off the trail, off the tracks a little bit, and they're unable to deal effectively, and they get very emotional, very stressed, and so on. Not a good situation. So that's just an example of what happens in personal life. And just as like it happens for business leaders, they often get stressed and aren't able to deal effectively with problems that come up. So what is a much more effective mental pattern is to think that failing to plan for problems is planning to fail. Again, failing to plan for problems is planning to fail. You need to plan for potential problems that might arise and how to address these problems in advance and integrate these problem-solving approaches into your strategic planning. So that's another example. And there are over 100 of these cognitive biases, specific patterns that researchers like myself have discovered that cause us to make really bad decisions that we need to address, and that business leaders and anyone actually who is not a business leader, anyone who wants to plan a wedding, anyone who wants to plan vacation, anyone who wants to plan their career, anyone who wants to open up a small business, you know, unfortunately, small business failure is incredibly high. If you look at small businesses, within the first 5 years, about half of all small businesses fail. And within the first 10 years, about 2/3 of them fail. So you need to go against your intuitions and be much more skeptical when you're opening up a small business if you don't want to lose your life savings that you've invested into it, for example. So my book, Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions and Avoid Business Disasters, looks at the 30 cognitive biases, dangerous judgment errors, that are most damaging, most harmful for business leaders and professionals, and shows them how to actually address each of these cognitive biases, and that are also separately from addressing the individual cognitive biases, there are specific techniques that you can use to address a number of them at a time when you're making a decision. But separately from those techniques, you need to learn about the cognitive biases and how to address each one individually, how to become aware of each one individually, because awareness is the first step, and then how to address each one individually in your professional activities and personal life.
I think awareness is probably the most important thing because, you know, we can all have our hand on, you know, the car door, the refrigerator door, whatever it is that we're doing, and become aware that this probably is not a very good thing that we're about to do. It may not be horrible for the short term, like eating that third cookie, but if you stop and think, breathe, just stop your momentum there for a moment, a lot of times you will reverse that decision. I do. And on another topic, I do a lot of comparing and contrasting, which has led me down the road. You know, I own my own business, which has led me not to make plans. I mean, I like to think I'm making plans, but I'm really not. What I'm doing is creating goals because goals are fluid. You can move around, you know, a lot easier than if you have a plan that in your mind is set in stone. I think you're going to be in big, big trouble. And I found that out way early on. So I don't plan. As you know, I mean, I don't plan for Christmas. I don't plan for a vacation. I've got a list. I've got things I want to follow. But I also know by comparing and contrasting all of my life that at some point I'm going to be stomping out fires. So I just plan for that. If I'm going to plan for anything, it's stomping out the fires.
Yeah. That's good.
I feel so smart right now.
That's good. No, you're essentially creating a disaster recovery plan, so to speak.
You are
addressing problems in advance, and that's one of the biggest strategies to address the planning fallacy. You want to identify what kind of problems might come up in advance. And well, there are two elements to this. One of the first things you do is when you can make plans, but as part of making a plan. So you're not making plans, that's fine. If you want to make plans, and if you're a small business owner and you don't have too many people working for you, it's fine not to make plans and just have goals. If you are a mid-sized business, you know, anywhere 50 people and above, you're going to have some trouble not making plans because the goal of planning, one of the important goals is to coordinate other people around you and make sure that they're all going in the same direction, because otherwise, you know, you're going to have a problem.
Right.
So you, for strategic planning, that's an effective technique. You can do strategic planning. It's not like you shouldn't do strategic planning. You should do strategic planning, but as part of your strategic planning, what you need to do is envision that, hey, whatever project you're working on, so let's say you're launching a product, let's just go with that. And you're launching a product, you want to stop before you actually launch the product and say, what are all the ways that this product launch can fail? To do that, the first thing to do is actually you imagine that it completely failed, because otherwise your gut reactions, your emotions are not going to give you permission to actually brainstorm effectively, because you're going to be constantly arguing against yourself saying, oh, it won't fail. I'm so awesome. I'm so great. I mean, these are not the thought patterns that will be going in your head consciously, but that's what your gut will be telling you. It will be telling you, no, this can't possibly fail because this is awesome. So you need to imagine that it completely failed, absolutely failed. Your product launch is just, you know, dead in the water. And then you need to think about all the plausible reasons. What are all the possible plausible reasons that it might have failed? You know, for example, let's say your marketing director gets hit by a bus, and he is the only one who is holding together a strategy for this product launch, and he gets hit by a bus, and that's why your product launch fails. Possible reason. Another reason, maybe you haven't researched the market well enough and the people don't really respond to the product, or you're not able to reach them effectively. Maybe the market is right, but you don't have the right tools to research to reach that market. All of those things are plausible. I've seen all of those things. Well, the marketing director, I didn't see him get hit by a bus, but I saw a marketing director actually have cancer just, you know, couple of weeks into the product launch plan, and that, you know, caused product launch failure because he had the whole plan in his head and he was managing all these pieces of it and they didn't have a backup. So what you need to do in those cases, you can address a number of these problems in advance very deliberately. You can have someone who is trained to be the backup for the marketing director. You know, whether this person, you know, gets cancer or not, you want to have a backup just in case, because this person is critical. For doing the research on the market, you can do a little bit more research on the market and make sure that the market actually wants your product. There are so many product launches that fail. I think I've seen statistics that say about 85% of product launches fail, the initial product launch fails, partially because there's not nearly enough market research and testing of whether people actually want the specific product that you're offering. And of course, you can also check whether you're able to reach the people who you're targeting with your marketing message. Sometimes the marketing message is placed in completely the wrong venue for the target audience. You know, if you want to reach, let's say, healthcare professionals with your product, you might not want to advertise it, on the Inc.com, because Inc.com, it's a great venue if you want to reach small businesses and entrepreneurs, but healthcare professionals don't really read Inc. So you might have the wrong messaging, and that happens very often. So you can address these problems in advance, one. Second, the second thing you can do is you can create disaster recovery plans, and it sounds like that's what Denise has been doing. So imagine, let's say, for your product launch, imagine that a competitor happens to launch the same product or a similar product, a competing product, within a couple of weeks of your own product. What do you do in that case? Now, there are lots of things you can do if you prepare a plan in advance to address this sort of scenario. And if you don't have a plan in advance, you'll be left really scrambling, and you will not be able to effectively address the competitor launching the product. You will tend to fall into the fight or flight response. You'll tend to make a decision that's way too quick and very either too defensive or too aggressive, and not have a very calm, considered response that actually effectively addresses the problem. So that's the one aspect of what you need to do if you're making strategic plans. The other aspect of what you need to do if you're making strategic plans for the product launch is you want to imagine that this launch succeeded extremely well. It's awesome, it's great, you know, everything's perfect and terrific. Now you want to think about all the reasons why it succeeded. So imagine it completely succeeded. Think about the reasons why it succeeded. Maybe the target market was picked perfectly and they spread words to their friends and, you know, they really quickly bought the product. You know, now you need to produce it very quickly and you don't have capacity. You know, that's a good problem to have, unless you have serious issues with capacity, as let's say Impossible Foods has had some serious issues with capacity because they didn't figure that the people who would be buying Impossible Burgers are mostly not vegetarian, are mostly not vegan. They're mostly ordinary folks who want to experiment with being a little bit more planet and friendly and so on. So they didn't quite figure out their target market, and they didn't understand how much it would be in demand. So they weren't prepared for it. So that's something you can address in advance by saying, hey, you know, maybe I'll succeed beyond my plans. Do I have excess capacity, or can I bring excess capacity online very quickly? And these are the kinds of things you want to plan for success as well as plan for failure. Then you'll be much better off when you actually launch the product. You'll be able to solve a number of problems in advance. You'll be able to take a number of steps to guarantee success in advance. And you might be prepared for unanticipated problems and unanticipated opportunities with plans to take advantage of both.
Exactly. And didn't Popeye's chicken have a similar problem? I guess it's Burger King.
Yes.
I don't eat through windows, but they had brawls and, you know, people getting knifed over that stupid chicken sandwich.
Yep.
I don't get it. But, you know, it's just
I don't
me.
Get it either, but, you know, there's a reason I don't go shopping on Black Friday.
Yeah, you and me both. I don't either, and I don't, you know, I don't eat through windows, but it's just not my thing. I'd rather cook. I'd love to cook, so, yeah, that's a whole other story. But one of the things that, and I was listening to you very intently and taking notes, is that, and I was with you right up until, you know, you said you have to examine your success, because I am launching a product and I'm very excited about it and I'm very in love with it, as we all are. And I was agreeing with you. My head was nodding until you got to the part. So, you know, what about the success? Like, oh, I never thought of that. So that was an eye-opener for me. I never thought of that. My thinking didn't get that far. So that just went on my, you know, Denise, you need to pay attention to this so you can continue to serve that market and replicate that success. I don't know why I didn't think of it. I think I was just so caught up in the technology and who is my market and what is the title of it, you know, all the minutiae of making one of these things work or not work.
You don't want your clients knifing themselves if they can't get enough of your product, right?
Right. It's crazy. So, you know, one of the things that you're talking about, which is so important, and product launches, I mean, they're almost born to fail. And then, you know, I belong to a lot of Facebook groups, and I don't really talk much in them, but I'm doing a lot of lurking, which means I'm picking up a lot of information. And I'm making notes, and I'm thinking, okay, don't do what that guy just did. Or, ooh, that's a pretty good idea. Or, even worse, what the hell were they thinking? You know, you kind of run the gamut with all of these things. But you're right. I mean, and some of these ideas are so great, but somewhere along the line, they just step in it. And I think it's so important as entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, product marketers, whatever it is we're doing, that we follow all of these steps. Find out who your market is. You know, how are you going to produce it? One of the things that I'm a web developer as well as, you know, owning a digital agency, and I love to build websites. Honestly, I practically do them in my sleep. And I will tell people, you know, because I consult with my clients a lot. I don't just hand them a really beautiful website and say, good luck, God bless, and off they go. It's just not the way I operate. But one of the things that I have found time and time and time again is if they don't really understand what their visitor is seeing and experiencing, they're kind of in a tough spot. So I will tell them, listen, I hear what you want. I hear what you think you need. I hear what you want to deliver. What I want you to do is sit around for about 3 days with a pen and a pad or whatever, however you best get your notes out of your head, and walk into your door, whether it exists or not, whether it's a mainstream, you walk into the building or it's completely virtual. I want you to walk into your own door and tell me what you see. But more importantly, I want you to tell me what you don't see. Because you're not looking for customer service at this point. You're looking for the customer experience. And if they're not getting what they need from you, they're not going to stick around, and I can't build what you're asking, because what you're asking me to build is woefully incomplete. And they go, oh. And then about a week later, we have another come to Jesus talk, and it starts building itself. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. People don't think about the experience of others. And so there's another technique here that is incredibly important to apply when you're trying to make a good decision. And that is considering an external perspective. You know, your mom might have told you about it, you know, through the old phrase of put yourself in other people's shoes. Consider the external perspective. Get outside of yourself. Think about what other people would experience. What are they experiencing if you're currently interacting with them, if you're currently in a relationship with them, in an exchange? What are they experiencing from you? What do they think that you are saying? And especially if you are in a tense interaction, try to interpret your words, your interactions, from a hostile perspective. So what would they think if they were somewhat hostile inclined towards you? So that's kind of an important aspect of conflict resolution and mediation. And of course, when you're launching a product, when you're looking at customers, think about what they're experiencing, what from their shoes, what are their needs? You know, a lot of people who are launching products make the mistake of selling the seeds instead of selling the lawn. You need to, people don't want seeds. They want a good lawn.
The steak and the sizzle, right.
Yes. So you want to think about what is going to be their experience. What are their needs? How are they going to feel that you are satisfying their needs? And that is the critical aspect that you're talking about here, Denise. You want to look from the customer's perspective, from their needs perspective, and when they go on your website, how will they immediately perceive that your website, that your product, whatever you're doing, is going to satisfy their needs, whatever their needs are.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, as marketers, as, you know, product creators, you're right. We fall in love with our stuff. It's like, oh, we got it. I'm actually shifting. I was so in love with my original plan that that I started writing a book about it, which is now on the scrap heap of history, because as I kept going, I realized that what I wanted to do had been done by a lot of other people and probably better, but it really wasn't something that I was all that passionate about or interested in. But along the way, I found something else that these people who are buying these kinds of products really need that is not being served. And I've tested, and again, you said something earlier, testing. And testing, I'm going to tell the audience right now, if you're not testing, don't bother launching. Test, test, and test again. Just don't leave that part of it out. And once I started testing this new idea, I went, oh. So I completely scrapped my original plan, and my new product launches in January, in the new year. And I'm very excited about it because it's not me being in love with it. It's everybody else going, when do we get our hands on it? Test, test some more. Yeah. And it just one of those things. You know, I kept not writing the book. I kept not building out the program because it didn't feel right. That was my instinct, if you will. But I just couldn't get my own head behind my own work. And after a while, I was like, what the heck is going on here? And then something else came along. I went, oh, there it is. So, you know, sometimes you just have to back up and say, maybe this is not the right thing or the right time. It's not easy to do. I mean, I have beat myself up over this a lot. A lot.
Yes, it's not an easy thing to do indeed, but it's a very important thing to do, and that's one of the counterintuitive strategies, because our intuition is to be in love with our product and say, isn't this a great product? Look at how awesome it is. Look at all the features, and you know, look at all the little things that I did to it to make it really great. But other people don't really care about that, however much we want to believe that they care about it. They care about their needs and how will the product satisfy their needs. So that's, again, a very counterintuitive thing. Right, and the very counterintuitive thing, people have to learn it over time, just like you did, Denise, that it's not an intuitive thing at all. It's something that has to be learned. And that learning, that's a healthy mental habit that people, so what we talked about, you know, it's just like being civilized, just like brushing your teeth, just like eating with your fork and knife. It's something that you had to learn over time to do because it's not intuitive. So successful business leaders, successful solopreneurs, successful people who launch products like yourself, learn about it. And again, it's not easy and intuitive and still make mistakes, but over time you get more into this mental habit. You develop this healthy mental habit of, you know, looking over your shoulder when you switch lanes and making sure that your audience actually wants to buy the what you're selling.
Exactly. And you said something else a little bit ago about, you know, what do you do as when you're trying to launch something and you launched it and it was successful, but then somebody else does basically the same thing a couple weeks later. Compare and contrast. I've been watching some of these really big marketers. I've invested in their courses. I've spent a lot of money with coaches and courses, and I don't begrudge any of it. Well, sometimes I do, but most of the time, my cat just knocks something over. Most of the time I don't. But one thing that I have noticed that smart marketers, when they're in the same kind of arena and they're talking about the same thing, they'll team up. And oh my gosh, that is massively successful for the most part. You wouldn't think they would because, I mean, I'm thinking of two people in particular, and these guys have massively well-known names and huge products. They teamed up, and I think they left Scorched Earth behind them. It's crazy how much money they've made and how many more people they've put together. So, you know, consider that. Don't try to go it alone if you don't need to.
Yeah, I think that's a very wise strategy. And that's kind of one of the things that we need to think about is how do you maximize success? Because, again, it's very not intuitive to go and collaborate with others. That's not a comfortable thing for us to do. But if we want to maximize our success, often it helps to collaborate with others and do the uncomfortable thing and help others out so that we get help in turn.
Absolutely. Listen, I know you've got to go to someplace else, and we've got about 5 minutes left. Is there anything that you really wanted to share before I let you go?
One thing I want to share is a very effective technique that addresses a lot of these cognitive biases for everyday decision-making. Now, my book, Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions and Avoid Business Disasters, has an assessment where you can assess what kind of cognitive biases you are personally vulnerable to and how you can address, gives you steps for addressing them. So that's the awareness of addressing each individual cognitive bias. It also talks about specific techniques that you can use for your decision-making, for big decisions, for everyday decisions. I don't have time right now to go for the big decision one because it's more complex and in-depth, because you want to make sure to get those decisions absolutely right and maximize everything from them, you know, whether you're deciding which product to launch and how to launch it, or which new job to take or so on, or you know, where to move your headquarters or your own personal home. However, if you want to not screw up an everyday decision, you want to make sure to maximize your chances of not getting a decision wrong. So address a number of problems, even if you don't squeeze every drop of water from the decision and maximize the correctness of it. Here are five questions that you need to ask about every decision. Again, five questions to avoid decision disasters. First, what important information did I not yet fully consider? Again, what important evidence did you not fully take into account? It's very intuitive for us, very tempting, to only look for information that confirms our beliefs and ignore information that doesn't. That's called the confirmation bias, one of the biggest cognitive biases out there. So you want to look for information that would cause you to go against your intuitions, try to prove that your preferred choice on this decision is wrong, and look for evidence that it's wrong. If you can't prove that it's wrong, that's great. It's most more likely to be correct, but you want to try to prove yourself wrong on this one. Next, what dangerous judgment errors, so the cognitive biases, did I not yet address? Again, what are the dangerous judgment errors that are playing a role here that you might not yet have addressed? So if you're making a strategic plan, obviously the planning fallacy. If you are deciding whether to work with a new business partner, then you might look at the tribalism aspects. There are two things to look at. The horns effect, where if we don't like one aspect of someone, we'll tend to not like that person as a whole, and the halo effect, where if we do like one person, aspect of someone that makes it feel like they're part of our tribe, we will tend to like that person as a whole. Third, what would a trusted and objective advisor suggest I do? So think about somebody who would be a trusted and objective advisor to you. Think about somebody wise, you know, think about someone like Denise. What would she suggest you do? What would someone who's trusted and objective suggest you do in this case? You can actually call this person or text them if you're a millennial, but you can actually get most of the benefit, about half of the benefit according to research, by just imagining what this person would suggest, because you take yourself outside of your own head. You get an external perspective on yourself. Fourth, how have I addressed all the ways this decision can fail? Again, how have you addressed all the potential problems in this decision? We already talked about a very good technique for that, where you imagine completely failed, think about all the ways that you can, that the reasons for failure and how you can address these reasons in advance. Finally, what new information would cause me to revisit this decision? Again, what would cause you to change your mind about this decision? So if we go with the product launch, you can say something like, hey, if I don't hit 450,000 within the first 6 months, then this will indicate that my product launch was screwed up and I really need to change things around in a very serious way. You want to decide this in advance. You don't want to decide this in the heat of the moment when you're actually trying to implement the decision, because it's very uncomfortable for us to step away from a decision when we're already implementing it, when we are in the heat of the moment, just going forward. So you want to decide in advance what would cause you to change your mind so that you can then feel good about just steaming ahead, implementing the decision, knowing that you have certain trigger points that would cause you to revisit things. So those are the five questions to avoid decision disasters in everyday decision-making, where you don't want to screw up a decision, but it's not the hugest decision that you want to maximize and get absolutely correct.
And these can become, I mean, once you train yourself to look at these five points, when you're looking at making a small decision, a big decision, a massive decision, I would think that they would become almost repetitive, intuitive. You just automatically do them. But you have to train
yourself. Yep, it takes a couple of months to develop that mental habit, just like, you know, it took a couple of months to develop the mental habit of looking over your shoulder when you switched lanes. That is the same sort of mental habit. You need to, or that it took some time to develop the mental habit of effectively responding to constructive critical feedback instead of, you know, shouting back, no, you're completely wrong, or shutting down and just ignoring what that person is saying. It's a mental habit that you need to develop. And after you develop it, it's very quick, very intuitive, takes right now I talked through it in 2 minutes. You can do it in less than that when you have it as part of your mental habit, as part of your habitual step of decision making. And it really helps you do the very critical thing of slowing down your decisions, because we tend to decide way too fast. That's a big, 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 huge problem for us. We tend to decide way too fast, go with our gut, and use the fight or flight response. You don't want to use that fight or flight response. You want to slow yourself down and have some steps, a decision-making process to evaluate things. These five questions allow you to do that. It's especially helpful when you get your whole team, if you have a team around you, on board in making, in asking these questions, because then you know what the other people are doing when they're going through their decision-making process. And it's much easier and healthier for you to know what they're doing, to discuss it with them. You know, you can discuss what was your answer to number four, how have you addressed all the ways this can fail, and so on, and make sure that you're on the same page. And it makes meetings so much more effective and fast, because you have everyone answer these questions before a decision-making meeting, and then you structure the agenda by using these questions. And it just makes things so much easier for everyone.
Oh, that's a terrific idea. Listen, where can people find you on the web, and where can they find your book?
Never Go With Your Gut, How Pioneering Leaders Make the Best Decisions and Avoid Business Disasters. My book is available in bookstores everywhere. It's been published by a great traditional business publisher, Career Press. So it's available everywhere from Barnes & Noble to indie bookstores, university bookstores, whatever. Props to indie bookstores. Check it out, of course, on the web and Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and any other book retailer online. Then, of course, you can go and find me on disasteravoidanceexperts.com. Again, disasteravoidanceexperts.com, the name of my company. You have a blog there, email list with resources, videos, audios, and more information on training, consulting, and coaching. You can reach me at gleb@disasteravoidanceexperts.com if you have any questions about anything I've said. Connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active there. Dr. Gleb, G-L-E-B, Tsipursky, T-S-I-P-U-R-S-K-Y, and follow me on Twitter, Gleb_Tsipursky.
Oh, I follow you everywhere. I have to ask you, though, I interview a lot of authors, and they all get excited across the board when they spot their book in an airport. Have you seen your book in the airport bookstores yet?
I have not seen it in the airport bookstores yet, but the book just came out on November 1st, so I haven't done that much traveling yet.
Well, when you spot it, send me a picture and I'll share it, because apparently that's how you know you have arrived, when you spot your own book in an airport. I don't know why, but they get so excited. Gleb, thank you so much. It has been a distinct pleasure speaking with you, and I thank you for all of the wonderful tips and advice that you've shared with our audience. And before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes and really anywhere else you consume your business podcasts. Just look for Your Partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Thank you.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.